It is related of King Ptolemy that he brought together 72 elders and placed them in 72 rooms without telling them why he had brought them together. And he went into each one of them and said to him, "Translate for me the Torah of Moses, your master." God then prompted each one of them, and they all conceived the same idea. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 37. Between Athens and Jerusalem, the invention of the Septuagint. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In 2008, a remarkable interview was conducted with two great scholars who were married to each other, Leon Cass and his beloved wife, the late Amy Cass of blessed memory. The two had both taught and written about great Western works throughout much of their lives, but Leon Cass had published his fascinating work on the Book of Genesis. The conversation was convened at Valparaiso University in order to discuss the tensions between the teachings of some of the earliest Western works, those affiliated with Athens, and those of the Hebrew Bible. Leon Cass was asked, quote, "Let me begin by exploring a question that is near and dear to the hearts of many of those who live and teach at Valparaiso University, where we sing in our campus hymn that we have here on one fair campus, Athens and Jerusalem. You have, in your writing, sharply contrasted the wisdom of Athens and Jerusalem. Are they finally antithetical? Was Tertullian right that Athens and Jerusalem have nothing to say to one another? Or are they in some deep sense compatible?" Leon Cass responded, "I think they are ultimately not compatible if you rightly distinguish the two points of departure. Wonder, seeking its replacement by knowledge, which makes the perplexities go away, on the side of Athens, versus, on the side of Jerusalem, the fear or reverence for the Lord, which is only the beginning of wisdom, but which is never superseded by a kind of full understanding or by comfort in the sufficiency of one's own powers. The spirit of these two points of departure is very different. Moreover, the wisdom of Jerusalem makes extraordinary demands on how you are to live. What begins with the fear and reverence of the Lord soon issues in a long list of commandments about how to live your life. By contrast, the pursuit of wisdom in the manner of Plato and Aristotle, following the model of Socrates, produces no obligations to community or family, and it seems that the highest kind of life is a private life of self-fulfillment through the pursuit of wisdom and reflection. That is a very different view of the good life from the one that is held up by the Bible, i.e., the life in community in pursuit of justice, holiness, and love of the neighbor. There are famous examples of people who try to marry their own scriptures with philosophical wisdom, the writings of Thomas Aquinas, for example. But the assimilation goes only so far in those cases. Finally, these two wisdoms are at odds with one another. The demands they make upon us are not easily harmonized." So Leon Cass said. To this, his wife Amy disagreed, saying, quote, "Why would you say that the two are not compatible? Why not say that one leads to or supplements the other, especially given the way you formulate the differences? I have objections to the way you formulate the difference. But why wouldn't you use the language of supplementation?" Leon Cass, in turn, responded to his wife by saying, quote, "The statement, the unexamined life is not worth living, the Socratic model, if you will, is very different from, it has been shown to you, O man, what the Lord doth require of you." And he added that, "The Bible, in part, begins by holding up a mirror in which we see the insufficiency of our intellect and the muteness of that which we exercise our mind, mainly the natural world and the world of our experience, for giving the proper instruction with respect to the human good. There is something radically different between a view of life in which nothing is immune to critical examination and a view of life that makes demands in both truth and practice, which you don't regard as the fruits of an inquiry." End quote. I have only quoted a portion of his response to you, and we have sent you a link to the entirety of this fascinating discussion. But I was struck by what Leon Cass said. For here we have a man, a scholar, steeped in the study of Greek wisdom, who has embraced the virtues of Hebraic texts, and here wisely reflects on the difference between the two traditions. Jewish tradition, of course, embraces the importance of reason and the capacity thereby for human beings to achieve great things. But Judaism still emphasizes above all fear, awe, reverence for the omniscience of the Almighty, whose wisdom dwarfs ours, whose revelation teaches us that we are made in his image and that therefore our own lives are endowed with meaning and purpose. And this is even more striking to me because here I think Leon Kass echoes and imitates a Jewish rabbinic sage who had a Greek name, a sage who helped articulate Jerusalem's response to Hellenism's arrival. And most striking of all, it is around the period of this sage that one moment of meeting between Jewish tradition and the Greeks will set the stage for the ultimate spread of biblical belief in the God of Abraham throughout much of the world. We have seen how for the Talmud, the arrival of Greek rule over Jerusalem took place during the age of Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Just, or Shimon the Righteous. The rule of Alexander over Jerusalem, as we have also seen, is soon succeeded by that of the Ptolemaic dynasty. The spiritual successor in Jerusalem of Shimon the Just was a Jewish sage with a strikingly un-Jewish name. Thus, rabbinic literature reports, Antigonus of Socho received the tradition from Shimon the Just. He used to say, "Be not like servants who serve their master because they expect to be rewarded, but be like servants who serve their master, not anticipating a reward, and let the fear of heaven be upon you." So we are told. The message here is very Jewish. Serve God because it is the right thing to do, and keep the fear of heaven upon you. But it is striking to receive this message from someone named Antigonus, which is definitely not a Jewish name. That the spiritual leader in Jerusalem is accorded such an appellation highlights to us how quickly and profoundly Hellenistic culture impacted Jerusalem. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik put it this way, quote, "Antigonus was a disciple of Shimon the Just. However, times had changed. Until his generation, we did not find in Jewish literature any scholars, national leaders, or high priests bearing Greek names. Antigonus is the first scholar of note who was given an alien name. Apparently, the period in which he lived was one in which Hellenistic influences had become a strong social and cultural factor in Jewish life and thought. The march of Hellenism in the Near East, which, notwithstanding the collapse of Alexander the Great's empire, continued to move at a very quick tempo, did not halt before the gates of the Holy City." End quote. And if Antigonus is emphasizing obedience to the Almighty and fear of heaven, this is, as Rabbi Soloveitchik further adds, in response to the Greek philosophical approach, which is all of a sudden ubiquitous. As Rabbi Soloveitchik explains, the Greeks focused on eudaimonia, a sort of happiness and well-being, as the ultimate purpose of life, without emphasizing righteous action stemming from obedience to God. And Antigonus, the man with a Greek name, is responding to Greek culture by emphasizing, as did Leon Kass, what Jerusalem emphasized against Athens, that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. Thus, Kass's own appreciative understanding of Judaism, expressed by a scholar such as himself who has learned deeply from Greek tradition, finds its own precedent in Antigonus of Socho, whose name reflects the new impact of Greek culture, but whose statement is actually a Hebraic response to that culture. Understanding this allows us to turn to a moment of meeting between Jerusalem and Athens that occurs in Egypt during this period, during the reign of what appears to be Ptolemy II. And that is the creation of one of the most important works in the history of the West. This is a translation of Hebrew scripture into Greek, known as the Septuagint, or in Hebrew, the Targum HaShivim, the translation of the 70, a name based on the tradition that it was created by around 70 Jewish sages brought by Ptolemy to Jerusalem, sages placed in separate rooms who nevertheless miraculously produced the same result. Here is the Babylonian Talmud's version of the story, which emphasized that the rabbis each gave certain Hebrew passages less than literal translations, usually in order to prevent misunderstanding by Greek readers. Quote, "It is related of King Ptolemy that he brought together 72 elders and placed them in 72 rooms without telling them why he had brought them together. And he went into each one of them and said to him, 'Translate for me the Torah of Moses, your master.' God then prompted each one of them, and they all conceived the same idea." End quote. 72 rabbis in 72 different rooms, each giving the exact translations of certain biblical phrases through a sort of revelation, or as the Talmud puts it, God prompted each one of them and they all conceived the same idea. We should not take this Talmudic tale as emphasizing the normative nature of the Septuagint as we have it today, for there are differences between that Greek text and the version of the Hebrew Bible embraced by Jewish tradition. But the meaning of the story, I think, lies in its highlighting the difference between Hellenism and Judaism. For the Talmudic story has inspired a joke that I heard, which went something like this. You think it's miraculous for 72 rabbis in 72 different rooms to all agree on translating the Torah? It would be more miraculous to have all those rabbis in the same room and agree on a translation. And thinking it over, I think there is profound wisdom in this joke, because the point, of course, of the quip is that Jewish interpretive culture is profoundly argumentative. The Talmud is replete with arguments, and this is as it should be, for Judaism cherishes intellectual debate and multiplicity of interpretation. And it is during this period, when prophecy has ceased, that the emphasis on human interpretation truly begins. And yet the Talmud, and speaking of a quasi-revelation in this moment, is teaching us that for the rabbis, argument and interpretation of the Bible is founded on the belief in the necessity of revelation and the insufficiency of human reason. Thus, Leon Kass was asked in this conversation, quote, "Do you think that there is within Jerusalem, as you appropriate that tradition, a kind of argumentative spirit akin to the Athenian with respect to its own sacred texts?" Kass replied about the Jewish tradition as follows, quote, "If you look really deeply into some of the sources, there is virtually no limit as to what can be raised for discussion, including various stories in which in one famous tale, God says exultantly, 'My people have defeated me.' God is, in other words, taking pleasure not in rebellion, but in the growth of human understanding. So there is that kind of spirit. I should say that I haven't by any means jumped ship on the subject of liberal education. Certainly in a secular university, given the purely utilitarian, vocationalist tendencies, even in the universities that claim to be interested in liberal education, bringing people to awareness of their ignorance and letting them see the deeper issues beneath opinions that they complacently hold and turning the soul around with good questions are marvelous aspirations in collegiate education. My reservations have to do with whether or not that kind of activity by itself can produce guidance for a good life. How does it contribute to good character, good citizenship?" End quote. Inquiry, in other words, is essential, but it is not enough. Awe before the Almighty is profoundly important for goodness and purpose, because again, the beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord. The translation of the Bible into Greek marked the moment that Jerusalem and its revelation launched itself upon the world. The rabbis both emphasized trepidation about this development, for the Bible is best and most accurately encountered in the original, while also recognizing that the translation of the Bible into Greek was a means whereby the achievements of Athens would ultimately encounter the revelation and the glory of the God of Abraham, who taught that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik reported that he once asked his father why the Talmudic rabbis in all their brilliance leave so many questions unresolved. His father replied in Yiddish, "Valayid muz wissen asadazachen vaser vesnet," because a Jew needs to know that there are things that he does not know. Awe before the Lord is truly the source of wisdom. But one thing we do know, with the heritage of Jerusalem accessible to Athens, the world will never be the same. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.